Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. The following recording takes place at the 2011 Roots of Change Conference in Portland, Oregon, which was sponsored by the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force and Men Can Stop Rape. Speakers and workshops address the primary prevention of sexual violence with a strong focus on media, entertainment, and pop culture. Themes regarding men and masculinity were woven throughout the conference proceedings. Dr. Rachel Griffin, Assistant Professor of Speech Communication at Southern Illinois University Carbondale, reflects on the intersection of her experience as a Black feminist survivor and Tyler Perry's film For Colored Girls.
More often than not, the audiences that I speak to are full of folks who wonder if gender violence really happens and if systemic oppression forces such as racism and sexism are real. Folks who, in my mind, are a little bit too excited about our recent national conversations on being a post-racial or post-feminist society. And these same folks, the students that I encounter in the classes that I teach, strangers on the sidewalk and at the gym, even members of my own family, which oftentimes really breaks my heart, very easily fall into line with the idea of, Rachel, it's just a song. Rachel, please don't ruin my favorite television show. Rachel, put that back on. Whenever I hear these comments that deny the seriousness of gender violence, that mask the existence of oppressive forces, and minimize the media's explicit role in reproducing oppression, I oftentimes interject with, I am happy as a biracial, black and white woman to be post-racism. And I am happy to be post-white privilege. And I am happy to be post-sexism or post-male privilege. But I have yet to have a day where moving through our world in a female black body does not matter. And please don't even get me started on the problematic media representations of men's violence against women. And that's on a good day. Now let me tell you what happens on a not-so-good day. The day when I'm a little bit tired of, frankly, I perceive as bullshit flowing out of people's mouths. On a not-so-good day, I tend to ramble with something to the effect of, somebody tell me where colorblindness actually works to the benefit of people of color, and then I need you to let me know where gender is inconsequential in the lives of women, and somebody fill me in on where and when survivors in general and survivors of color in particular are humanized, respected, and revered in the media. Are you for real? In response, as I'm sure you can imagine, eyes widen and faces drain of color. Unsure of how to respond to the quintessential angry black woman. And let me be transparent. I am an angry black woman. Unapologetically, rationally, and rightfully so. I am sad, devastated, and emotional, but I am not unstable, crazy, or outside of myself. In fact, when I say I am an angry black woman, it is one of the few times in my everyday life that my voice is coming from within. And if you are like me, you often look out into the world with a gaze of frustration. You spend many of your days angry with the reality that gender violence is at worst encouraged and at best ignored and condoned by our social institutions, including, but of course not limited to, the media. If you are like me, you spend your nights enraged, can't get a wink of sleep at the politics of indifference toward the grim realities of systemic oppression. And let me tell you something from a personal standpoint. I have felt the angriest and the loneliest in our world when, as a woman of color, I have learned hard lessons about whose bodies, whose dreams, and whose lives are worthy of protecting. My own conscious activism around gender violence began for myself when I was working on my undergrad and master's degrees at Central Michigan University, when I became something that they call a sexual assault peer advocate. It was a campus advocacy group. And as an advocate, I answered crisis calls, presented educational programs on campus and at conferences, and was a sexual assault nurse examiner volunteer. After CMU, I went to the University of Denver to earn my PhD in 2004, and that same year is when I began speaking nationally. Currently, I am an assistant professor, and I'm housed in the Department of Speech Communication there, but I identify as a critical intercultural scholar, which for me means, as Jenna said, a whole lot of politically incorrect. Power, privilege, black masculinity, sport, gender violence, pop culture, really anything that makes folks a little bit uncomfortable, that's where we start. In Carbondale, I also volunteer at our local Women's Center, and I sit on the Rape Crisis Services Board Committee. But folks, what I need you to understand from the inside of my heart is that before all of that ever came to be, before I was an advocate, before I had a bachelor's or a master's degree, before I became what I call the fancy Dr. Griffin, I was a survivor of rape. And before I was a survivor of rape, I was a survivor of childhood domestic violence. You know, I look out into this room, I look out into any room that I speak or teach in, and I know that many folks are drawn to helping survivors because they have been hurt by gender violence, either personally or by relation. And I want to mark my humility in standing in front of you, because for me, it's always important to bear witness to the pain that we know is present in this room. I want to spend some time generally mapping what the foundation of Black feminism and Black feminist thought can offer our advocacy against gender violence. Black feminist thinkers, writers, and activists, they teach us about the histories of Black women and remind us that historical voices must be heard in our contemporary efforts. They teach us about the legacy of Black female resistance, and they remind us that the struggle remains. Black feminist authors, writers, and activists teach us how far we have come and remind us that we must go further. It's the hard part about this field. Our work is never done. Then, after we engage with Black feminist texts, I'm going to turn a critical Black feminist eye toward Tyler Perry's recent screenplay adaptation of Entezaki Shange's For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide, When the Rainbow is Enough. Paying attention to Perry's screenplay in particular, for those of you that are wondering, why would you go there, right? It's important for several different reasons. The first and foremost reason is the significance of Shange's original choreo poems. Her work in the 1970s was nothing short of revolutionary in the aftermath of the feminist and civil rights movements, both of which purposely excluded Black women. The exclusion of Black women is perhaps most eloquently captured by the title of the very first Black women's studies edited collection that was published in 1982. And the title of that collection was All the Women Are White, All the Blacks Are Men, But Some of Us Are Brave. Second, another reason that looking at Tyler Perry's screenplay is important is because Black women have been crying for longer than my lifetime in reaction to seeing For Colored Girls theatrically staged, because they could identify so intensely with her poetic representations of Black womanhood. And we must pay attention when people cry. And finally, Perry's screenplay is important because, as hard as it is for my Black feminist soul to admit, that man introduced a new generation of women to Entezaki Shange and her work because he has access to mass media. And because, folks, if you think about it, For Colored Girls, Tyler Perry's edition, it's really one of the only representations in the media that we have of Black female survivors. We have very few, and they are far between. And also, and those of you who've seen the film, you know that the film itself, it's not just about gender violence. It's also related to issues of sex, sexuality, abortions, relationship, and sisterhood. And all of those topics are very central in the lives of Black women. So to ignore those topics is to ignore Black women. We must look at this particular pop culture text. You know, what I find clearly disheartening when I look out into the world from a Black feminist standpoint are the ways that Black female survivors in particular are often forgotten, overlooked, and dismissed. However, I want us to tread carefully here. I'm not saying that Black female survivors of gender violence hurt more or less than perhaps a Black male survivor or a Muslim female survivor. Using myself as an example, I don't think that I hurt less than a heterosexual white female survivor because I'm a person of color. And I don't think I hurt less than a Latina lesbian survivor. Rather, all survivors hurt differently. And although our pain is very different and important at the intersections of identity, our pain is equally as tragic. So it's not about hurting more or hurting less. It's about how can we understand the nuance of hurt that gender violence brings. That being said, when we look to spaces where specific isms overlap, such as racism and sexism, we can get a more nuanced understanding of how gender violence is normalized, particularly today, normalized in the lives of Black women. Illustrating the normalization of gender violence in the lives of Black women, they represent 8% of the population, but 29% of all female victims of intimate partner homicide. Almost 20% of Black women report experiencing rape in their lifetime, and approximately 3 million Black women in this moment have been sexually abused in their lifetime. And of course, as everyone in this room knows, those statistics are likely incredibly low because of reporting and the ways that crimes are classified. At the intersections of multiple forms of oppression, such as race, gender, ability, class, sexual orientation, and religion, Black women are more vulnerable to gender violence, and yet the public and the media, we know, the public and the media take the sexual violation of Black women less seriously, and they oftentimes trivialize their experiences in the rare instance that a Black woman is visible in the media as a victim or as a survivor. Capturing the essence of Black female survivor invisibility and that Black feminist efforts work to resist, the names and narratives of Nicole Brown Simpson, JonBenet Ramsey, Lacey Peterson, Natalie Holloway, and J.C. Lee Duggard are commonly known, or at least recognized, as they should be. And yet, the names and narratives of Margaret Allen, Tanya Hunter, Letitia Green, Nikki McFadder, and Megan Williams are largely unknown. Margaret Allen was an attorney strangled by her boyfriend in 2008. Tanya Hunter was a 42-year-old marriage and family counselor when she was murdered in 2010. Her husband is accused of the crime. Letitia Green was a 22-year-old transgender Black woman shot to death outside of a party. Nikki McFadder was shot by her boyfriend in 2009. Megan Williams, she was only 20 when she was kidnapped and tortured in 2009. Their absence in the media says something about who is valued, remembered, and protected in U.S. American society. Take a minute. Think about it. Do you know their names? And why not? When I think about the prevalence of gender violence in the lives of Black women, coupled with the silencing of our voices and the invisibility of our experiences, I am reminded of Entezaki Shange's refrain in For Colored Girls when the lady in brown says, "Somebody, anybody, sing a Black girl's song. Bring her out to know herself, to know you, but sing her rhythms. Karen, struggle, hard times, sing her song of life. She's been dead so long, closed in silence so long. She doesn't know the sound of her own voice." Whenever I talk about Black women and gender violence, this poem comes to mind. I think of myself as engaging in call and response, right, across generations. I think what saddens me the most is that we still need to bear witness to Shange's call more than 30 years later. We have come far, but we have much further to go. In the midst of these grim statistics and what I mark as dangerous indifference toward gender violence, I want to acknowledge that as a survivor and an activist that I am often afraid, literally shaken in my boots. Sometimes I am afraid that my family, my friends, my students, my neighbors, my colleagues won't understand my need to name, to deconstruct, to resist all the ways that all women are told that they do not matter. Sometimes I am afraid, especially in rooms full of white folks who don't look like me, that you will easily brush me off your shoulder as an angry Black woman, as if there isn't a damn good reason to be angry. And yet I am reminded by Black lesbian feminist Audre Lorde that, quote, "We can sit in our corners mute forever while our sisters and ourselves are wasted, while our children are distorted and destroyed, while our earth is poisoned. We can sit in our safe corners mute as bottles, and we will still be no less afraid." To me, this means that our cultural silence will not lessen our fear, nor will it diminish the pain that survivors endure. And although those who love me, and even those who don't, right, would never call me an optimist as a critical intercultural scholar, or really just as an everyday person, I do believe in the power of imagination coupled with a determined desire to create a more just society. To be frank, I believe, looking out into the world, that the world as it is simply is not the best that it can be. This, for me, is where feminism knocks at the door of possibility. And folks, I answer, and I answer quick, right? I answer because feminisms, or more accurately, feminisms, plural, offer such a rich narrative and conceptual legacy for us to draw from. I imagine that in this room, the embrace of feminism isn't new to many of us. But let's go to a hard place. Because even in the embrace of feminism, oftentimes the contributions of feminists of color are missing, which serves as an example of how white privilege and racism and whiteness can infiltrate the work of people like us who have the absolute best social justice intentions. However, where I find hope is that we can learn to look to the legacy of feminists of color. We can learn to look to first, second, and third wave black feminists, or perhaps somewhere in between those waves. If you're like me, I struggle with the idea of the waves, but it's our language in this moment, right? And to do otherwise, to not look, to disregard their work through ignorance, through absence, through erasure, is to negate the powerful legacy of black female resistance that has been embodied by women. And please bear with me as I read their names, because when we bring their names to voice, it matters, right? Sojourner Truth, Harriet Jacobs, Maria Stewart, Anna Julia Cooper, Ida B. Wells Barnett, Zora Neale Hurston, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, Maya Angelou, Alice Walker, Toni Morrison, Bell Hooks, June Jordan, Angela Davis, Michelle Wallace, Audre Lorde, Barbara Smith, Barbara Ransby, Beverly Guy Sheftall, Rebecca Walker, Crystal Brent Zook, and Joan Morgan, just to name a few. If you don't know them, why? Reading their names out loud reminds me of my own introduction to black feminist thought. I want you to come with me as I remember. The first time that I read Bell Hooks' Ain't I a Woman, Black Women and Feminism, I got chills as she insisted that the world take notice of the maltreatment of black women. She used words as her weapon. She forewarned me of the war at the crossroads of race and gender. Bell Hooks not only found me and affirmed me, but most importantly, she helped me discover self-love is my sanctuary in a world that refuses to afford women of color humane status. And my goodness, it was reading her work that for the first time that I realized and had the courage to say out loud that I live in a society where brown bodies like mine have been legally considered properly longer than we have been considered free. In this moment, I am reminded by Fannie Lou Hamer that, quote, a black woman's body was never hers alone. Angela Davis in Women, Race, and Class marked permanent discontent with the ways that black women are erased out of history. I felt inspired by her desire to mark the purposeful orchestration of black female suffering as shameful and nothing short of shameful. Her words changed me as she recounted the horrors of gender violence during slavery to make certain that those who suffered beyond our contemporary imagination are not forgotten. And after Davis came my first reading of Black Feminist Thought by Patricia Hill Collins, which is now in its third edition. Collins brought my pen to life in a way that I had never known before. As I turned each page, I scribbled in the margins to record all of the ways that I knew her words to be true. When she said, quote, by insisting on self-definition, black women question not only what has been said about African-American women, but the credibility and the intentions of those possessing the power to define. She says, when black women define ourselves, we clearly reject the assumption that those in positions granting them the authority to interpret our reality are entitled to do so. If you look at the first copy of the book that I read, you will find the words, amen, 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 scribbled in the margins. And every time I return to Pearl Cleage and Mad at Miles, A Black Woman's Guide to Truth, and read these words out loud, it changes me. She says, I am writing to expose and explore the point where racism and sexism meet. I am writing to help myself understand the full effects of being black and female in a culture that is both racist and sexist. I am writing to try and communicate that information to my sisters first, and then to any brothers of goodwill and honest intent who will take the time to listen. She says, I am writing because I am a daughter and a mother and a lover and a sister and a womanist. I am writing to understand. I am writing so I won't be afraid. I am writing so I won't start crying again. I am writing because no one even said the word sexism to me until I was 30 years old, and I want to know why. She says, I am writing because I have seen my friends bleed to death from illegal abortions. I am writing because I have seen my sisters tortured and tormented by the fathers of their children. I am writing because I almost married a man who beat me regularly and with no remorse. I am writing because my daughter is almost old enough to start dating, and I don't know how to tell her how to protect herself from what I cannot even fully articulate myself. I am writing to allow myself to feel the anger. I am writing, writing, writing for my life. Her words change me. Do they change you? Clearly, if you checked in with my students, I could go on for days in terms of how the activist insight from Black women of the past and the present has altered my perspectives on Black women and oppression and gender violence. But we do need to take the turn toward Tyler Perry's For Colored Girls to make sure that we have a practical example of how the work of Black feminist activists can help us critique the normalization of violence against Black women, particularly in the media. Thus, our project today is to deconstruct the power and politics surrounding Perry's adaptation of For Colored Girls in relation to Black women and gender violence. And folks, this seems especially fitting when we remember that 2011 marks 20 years since Anita Hill and Desiree Washington came forward as Black female survivors of gender violence. And 20 years later, let's be real clear, they remain, for many, the most visible representations of Black female survivors in the media. 20 years later, that tells me that the way they were treated taught survivors like me something about what happens to Black women when they come forward and ask for the help that they need and deserve. The absence of Black female survivors in the media teaches me what can happen to my body, to my soul, to my life when I come forward and say, somebody hurt me. I need help. There's a reason we don't hear that from women who look like me. So although we will focus on For Colored Girls, I encourage you, of course, to explicitly work feminist frameworks and critical concepts into your own educational and outreach efforts, not only to problematize the different representations of gender violence in pop culture, but also because when we incorporate elements of pop culture at the intersections of identities like race, gender, ability, sexual orientation, and religion, we also send messages to our clientele and people who might walk into our offices and need help that we give a damn about who they are and that we recognize that all of who they are is significant. So now I'm going to walk you through a PowerPoint version of a book chapter that I wrote to critique Tyler Perry's screenplay adaptation of Entezaki Shange's Koria poems. The book chapter that I wrote is part of an edited collection, and if anyone in here knows anything about academic publishing, it is going to be a while before it gets into print, which is why one of my commitments as a scholar is to bring the academy outside of the academy in more of a timely manner so that we can actually engage with publications when the pop culture texts are still quite recent. So what I'm hoping, yeah, that's my crack against the academy. My gosh, what can possibly take so long, right? But, I mean, it's likely that I wrote the book chapter when the movie came out. It probably won't be available in the book until 2013. And that might actually be early in terms of publication press times, okay? So what I'm hoping is that by walking you through the chapter, that it serves as one example of one way to make feminist theories and concepts more accessible to critique pop culture. Because part of the problem that we have in the academy is that our work isn't accessible, especially to folks on the ground doing crisis work. Who in this room besides myself or anyone else who's an academic has time to read, right? So the idea is to bring the academy outside into places where academic work can do a better job of getting into everyday life. So it seems a sensible starting point seems to be sharing Black feminist definitions of what Black feminism can mean. So when we think about how Black feminists articulate feminism, I think it's important to bring their words to voice. Barbara Smith says, feminism is the political theory and practice that struggles to free all women. Women of color, working class women, poor women, disabled women, lesbians, old women, as well as white, economically privileged, heterosexual women. Pearl Cleage says feminism is the belief that women are full human beings. Imagine that, right? Capable of participation and leadership in the full range of human activities, intellectual, political, social, sexual, spiritual, and economic. And bell hooks says feminism is the struggle to end sexist oppression. Its aim is not to solely benefit any specific group of women, any particular race or class of women, right? So I put these particular words up for you because I want you to know, those of you who maybe don't engage with Black feminist scholars or aren't familiar, that their work is very much in alignment with what we consider mainstream feminist work. So the bridge to inclusion really is perhaps much easier if we start positioning their work as accessible and start using it explicitly. Beyond broad definitions, I also want to highlight the nuances of Black feminist thought in particular. And to do that, we need to identify the key foundational commitments. So Black feminist thought highlights the simultaneous marginalization by, at minimum, race and gender, and it does so in a particular nuanced way. It's not the idea that a Black woman's experience or any woman of color's experience is race plus gender or race plus gender plus class. It's not that easy. Our identities are layered, which means that our experiences are multiplicative. So we can't just add people up and get a sense of what their life will be like. We have to account for the layers and the complexities of identity. In addition, Black feminist thought highlights history, context, power, and privilege. The dismissal, dehumanization, and or invisibility in everyday life of Black women, and of course, in mainstream media. And Black feminist thought emphasizes self-definition, agency, voice, and empowerment. And if you're unsure about what agency means, agency is the fancy academic term used to refer to this idea of decision-making, right? So having the agency to make decisions, to have control in your own everyday life. In addition, Black feminist thought, particularly bell hooks, does something lovely when it comes to the media. She offers us active means or active tools of resistance. And there's three different ways that I'm going to talk about her own tools that you can literally lift up out of her texts to apply to media. The first one is critical consciousness. And when bell hooks advocates for critical consciousness, she wants us to approach media with a critical eye, opposed to regarding the media as innocent entertainment. The way that I describe that to my students is oftentimes, and maybe many of us in here, at the end of a long day, we go home, put on our comfy clothes, put our feet up, and let the media soak on in. And bell hooks says, yeah, not the best idea, right? We need to approach it with a critical eye, opposed to kicking back and letting it all seep through. She also talks about another concept called talking back. And I'll read her words out loud. And the essence of talking back is really shifting from an objectified standpoint to a subject standpoint. So it's an act of humanizing yourself. She says, talking back is moving from silence into speech. It's for the oppressed, the colonized, the exploited, and those who stand and struggle side by side, a gesture of defiance that heals, that makes new life and new growth possible. It is that act of speech, of talking back, that is no mere gesture of empty words. That is the expression of our movement from object to subject, the liberated voice. So we can talk back to media. And last but not least, she talks about Black feminist spectatorship, right? And this idea that we can arrive to a pop culture text the way that I arrived for Colored Girls with an oppositional gaze, looking for instances where power and privilege are significant. And what I want to make clear is that you do not have to be Black and or female. You don't have to be Black and or female to engage in critical consciousness, talking back, or to use a Black feminist spectatorship lens, right? So it's equal opportunity for all kinds of folks. Now, the other aspect that's particularly relevant to the media are the ways that Black feminist thought helps us understand controlling images that are used not only in historical lenses, but also in contemporary society. And what these controlling images do is they control the possibilities around who Black women can be, how they can be remembered, and how they can be talked about. And they also control the meanings. What meanings does my Black female body carry? So breeders, of course, come out of the slave era, chattel property, and wet nurses. That was one of the only positions that Black women were allowed to have in public society. Mammies, same era, crossing over into segregation, were regarded as maternal, domestic, and accommodating. Hattie McDaniel from Gone with the Wind is usually the example that's commonly, highlighted. But I also want to represent that mammies are still very present. For example, go into the breakfast aisle of any given grocery store and you will see Aunt Jemima pancake mix, okay? Jezebels, also known as the tragic mulatto, are typically regarded as hypersexual and seductive temptresses. Black Women as Sapphires comes out of the 1950s era with the show Amos and Andy, where black folks were performed by white folks in blackface. They're regarded as evil, hateful, dangerous, sassy, if you will, black women. Matriarchs come out of the 60s, 70s, early 80s, where black women were regarded as being too independent and emasculating, and the blame was placed upon black women during those eras for being the head of single-parent households, as if they were less independent and treated their men better, their men might stay, okay? And then last but not least, welfare queens, who are often regarded as fraudulent, lazy, and manipulative. Now, what's so significant about these controlling images, there's a few different things. One of them is that they can work independently or together, right? But what I always want us to remember is that oftentimes, these are the only ways that our media knows how to talk about black women. And I know this in contemporary society because you saw journalist after journalist after journalist trying to figure out how in the world to talk about now First Lady Michelle Obama. They couldn't figure out how to represent her because these controlling images are the only possibilities that we have in dominant media discourse. In addition, in the context of gender violence, stereotypical images are often invoked to limit possible representations and to excuse sexual violence against black women. For example, mammies are oftentimes considered asexual and unattractive, which makes it difficult to believe that anyone would want to engage sexually, right? In addition, Jezebels, they ask for it and they enjoy it. Sapphires are mean, right? They treat men like crap, so they deserve what they get. And welfare queens, of course, they will do anything for money, okay? So these controlling images in our media, which it's very, very rare to see any black women talked about outside of these images, or not in relation to these images. These images control how we think about media. And from a black feminist standpoint, unless we undo the ways that racism and sexism inform our everyday lenses that we interpret the world through, then these images will take hold. And moving forward, I want to share what I share with my students. When I think about theory or concepts, I teach my students that when you work with theory or concepts that are more so academic and you get all kinds of definitions and you get all kinds of quotations about what those definitions mean, I think about feminist theory as a pair of glasses, right? So you put on your black feminist theory glasses and you can look through those glasses at pop culture and you see certain things. You see particular things that stand out. But you would see different things if you put on your queer theory glasses. You would see different things if you put on your critical race theory glasses. So I want to do some talking about what we see when we look at Tyler Perry's For Colored Girls, okay? Now, first, black feminist thought necessitates the consideration of both history and context. So before we get to the film, just in case you're not familiar, I want to share with you more about what N. Tozaki's original work was designed to do. So first, the title of her work, which Tyler Perry shortened to For Colored Girls, was For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. And to share with you the significance of the title, because she crafted that title with exquisite attention, she says that one day while driving on the highway, she passed under a double rainbow. And reflecting on that day, as someone who had contemplated and attempted suicide many times, she says, quote, "In that moment of seeing the double rainbow, I felt connected to the delicacy and irrepressible majesty of life," meaning that this was the moment passing under that double rainbow that N. Tozaki Shange, having endured violence as a black woman, decided to live. She also purposefully chose the word colored because it was a term that her maternal grandmother could understand and relate to. So she created something called choreopoems, which represents the artistic fusion of text, movement, and music. And the choreopoems were first staged in 1974, then they hit Broadway in 1976. And she wrote the choreopoems to reflect the lived realities of seven black women. And each woman in the choreopoems was referred to by a color rather than by name. And she did that to mark their individual beauty through color, but also to mark their joint interdependence as members of this collective rainbow. Describing the power, if you will, of her own work, she says, or the power, the intent of her own work. She says, in the words of young black girls growing up, her triumphs, her errors, our struggle to become all that is forbidden by our environment, all that is forfeited by our gender, all that we have forgotten. So that was her intent in creating the choreo poems and struggling to have them staged, illustrating the strength of her initial work, right? I want you to know that for colored girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow was enough, was staged over 10,000 times in North America. And that's no small feat for a black female theater producer to get into that many theaters time and time again. And I also want you to know that tickets and shows were sold out. You had people dressed to the nines standing outside in freezing cold weather. So you know that probably meant a whole bunch of women with bare legs or nylons or something of that sort just waiting to get in for a seat. And people didn't only see it once, they saw it two and three times. It was that moving. Having seen the stage performance in the 1970s, Iles recalls the force of Shange's writing when she says, Shange's writing seemed to say, fuck the old rule of not airing your female business in front of colored men, white people, and let alone the rest of the world, right? And since then, the choreo poems have been referred to as, quote, the most important work about black female identity ever. They've also been described as a black feminist Bible, right? These poems were huge, huger than what many of us can ever even grasp. But that's part of the reason that it's so important to look at what Tyler Perry did to a, quote, black feminist Bible and taking it to the mass media. So the critical questions we arrive with when it comes to applying black feminist theory to for colored girls, what does a critical black feminist lens see in the film? What does the film teach us about black women and gender violence? And then, of course, for myself or perhaps for you, how can I talk back to the film to raise critical consciousness about black women and gender violence? And before I go any further, I must begin with a confession, okay? Tyler Perry and I, we don't get along. He doesn't know that we don't get along, nor do I know that he would care if he knew that he and I don't get along. But the relationship between Tyler Perry and myself is strained with struggle, right? I struggle with the representations that he pieces together in his films of people who look like me. Oftentimes, they are laden with stereotypes about black folks. However, as a biracial black woman, my struggle is tempered by admiration for his journey, from an abusive childhood to small stage plays where he was begging to get in the back door on any stage that he could, to the determination that it took for him to create Tyler Perry Studios, which in this moment right now is the only black-owned film production studio in this country, right? So familiarity with his films and the struggle they bring forth is why, I'm sure you can imagine, I arrived to the theater to see For Colored Girls, and I felt sick. I was like, oh, this is going to be bad. This is going to be real bad. And having been disappointed by Tyler Perry before, I waited. Folks, I was sitting on the edge of my critical, intercultural, black feminist seat, waiting for the second to swear off Tyler Perry for the rest of my life. And to my complete surprise, the moment never arrived. And I was a little disappointed, too, because I was ready to swear him off, right? I was about done with him. But I need to say that before we start critiquing Tyler Perry. So we're going to critique Tyler Perry, and then we're going to shift back into the possibilities. And I say that because with pop culture, I have never won the argument with my students, my family, or anyone else that a pop culture text is bad, horrible, and should be turned off. Nobody should have cable. Trash your iPod and don't go to iTunes anymore. I've never won that argument. The argument that I have won is let's go for both and. Let's talk about how it can do good things and also simultaneously bad things. So I do want us to shift and shift others into that contradictory space of, gosh, you know, I engage with this pop culture text and it might be problematic in some ways, but ooh, I really like it, right? I'll confess, I love trashy magazines at the gym. Cosmo, People, InStyle. I know those magazines are problematic when it comes to the representations of women. And the idea is to approach the magazines or approach the pop culture text with a critical eye. Okay, so let's go for both and, good and bad, opposed to either or. Now, let's dish. Tyler Perry and undoing black feminist art. And folks, He undid some business, all right? So first of all, he intertwines the lives and the lives of the original seven. So for example, if you've read the poetry and you listen to the film, you'll notice that the lady in yellow says the lines of Shange's Lady in Red. The lady in purple says the lines of Shange's Lady in Yellow, just as a few examples. So it's not consistent with Shange's original narratives. In addition, in the original staged performance, Shange had seven black women who were from seven different major cities around the U.S. In Tyler Perry's film, all of the women were represented in some way in relation to a Harlem tenement. So you lost that wide range of this is how black females are experiencing issues related to black femininity and violence across the nation. He located them all in Harlem, which is very stereotypical, right, might I add, from a critical standpoint. In addition, he adds three black female characters, and he names them, right? So they don't go by color. The characters, they're represented through color, but they have actual names, which decreases Shange's commitment to interdependence. He also centers black male characters. If you've never seen a staged version of the show, black men don't actually appear in the staged version, but they are very much in the film. He polices black womanhood. A great example of that, if you've seen the film, is Whoopi Goldberg's character of Alice, who imposes religious morality by policing her daughter Nyla, and Nyla's the lady in purple. She polices her sexuality to the point where she literally, in a very stereotypical manner, pours oil over her daughter's head and screams, "Repent, repent, repent." Might I also add, in terms of colorism or color symbolism, that Whoopi Goldberg is the darkest black female in that movie. And she is also represented as a religious fanatic, right? And that, too, is not by accident. And, of course, our argument for today is that he reproduces controlling images and normalizes men's violence against women. And what you see down here, this is part of the scene that we're going to talk about next. I do want to warn you that the scene I'm going to talk about, the two scenes I'm going to talk about in particular, are difficult. Right? It's a scene involving domestic violence that ended in the murder of children, and then the other scene I'm going to talk about is the rape scene. So hold on to your seats because we're going to go there, right? And we're going to go there because our people, and when I say our people, I mean our world, this is what they see. So we need to talk about what they learn when they see these particular images. So first and foremost, this is Bo Willie, and this is Crystal. And Crystal plays the lady in brown, okay? Crystal's character, if you watch closely, is very much represented as a contemporary mammy and matriarch, remembering that the controlling images can work together in interesting ways. When we think of Crystal as a mammy, or when the mammy image is brought back into our minds, we see the mammy because she's subservient to her partner, Bo Willie, who is a war veteran who struggles with alcoholism, and she's also subservient to her boss, Joe, and Joe is the woman played by Janet Jackson, the lady in red, okay? In addition, Crystal is very self-sacrificing in terms of being a mammy. She's self-sacrificing in her relationship, she's self-sacrificing for her children, she's self-sacrificing at work, right? You oftentimes see very much downcasted eyes that can be interpreted as shame and or apology out of her. So self-sacrificing, subservient, and definitely in that caretaking position. In addition, there are also moments where she's very much the matriarch. And the matriarch representation is what becomes exceptionally significant in relation to gender violence. As a matriarch, Crystal is positioned as emasculating her husband. A theme through the movie is that Crystal is refusing to marry Bo Willie, okay? And then in addition to that, she also asks him on different occasions in the movie to change his behavior. At one point, she tries to get him not to drink. She asked him not to yell. She asked him to consider the children. Now, walking you through the scene that I think brought most folks to tears, right, the scene that shocked folks, we need to talk about the day that Bo Willie murders their children. On that day, Crystal had been chauffeured home from work with her boss, Joe, to retrieve a page of a report that she had mistakenly left behind. While Crystal is searching for the missing page, Bo Willie accosts her with a drunken, "I saw you pull up in that car. I thought your boss was a woman," because he can see the driver. He can't see her boss in the back seat. And then he says, "You think I'm crazy, don't you, huh? You think I'm crazy." And from behind, what we see in the film as spectators, we see Crystal's posture shift as a woman who recognizes the threat of violence in her partner's tone. Then the camera shifts into Gilda's apartment, and Gilda is Crystal's neighbor. And Gilda is watching the children that day. And what she does with the children sitting on her lap is she starts to tell the children a story. As Kwame, the little boy, asks, "Is that my mama?" when he hears his mother screams through the walls. We think Harlem tenement, not soundproof, right? After Bowley beats her, Crystal is shown cleaning up her cuts and bruises because her boss is still waiting downstairs in the car. And when she returns to the living room, the children are playing with their father when he greets her with, "You're going to be a whore your whole life?" Gathering the children in her arms to protect them from him, Crystal responds, "Bo Willie Brown, you want the kids to see you acting a fool?" Then Bo Willie, calling the children back to him, and the children go, says, "I just want to hold them. I just want to marry you and give you things." And then Crystal refuses his marriage proposal. She says, "Damn it, Bo, no, I'm not going to marry you. My babies can't keep seeing their mama like this." And from there, Bo Willie has the children, and the scene begins to escalate toward panic and rage. Bo Willie is convinced in his drunken state of mind that the children are not his, and he kicks out the screen of their fifth floor window and he dangles the children outside. Ridiculing Crystal, right before he drops the children, he says, "You're just a damn whore. Is that your man down there in the car? Are these his kids too? You're gonna marry me, bitch? Answer." And with Crystal screaming in the background, we see Bo Willie's hands let go. Okay. Watching this scene without critical consciousness about men's violence against women, the controlling images of Crystal as mammy and matriarch at the intersections of those controlling images easily lead to victim blaming. This is especially visible through Crystal's interactions with her neighbor, Gilda. And Gilda is played by Felicia Rashad, those of you who are Cosby Show fans, right? I have a puppy named Huxtable. We do call him Dr. Huxtable, right? So I did appreciate seeing Felicia Rashad up on the screen again. But her character, too, is problematic because following the children's death, she lets herself into Crystal's apartment to care for her. And when Crystal forlornly asks, "How could he do it?" Gilda answers with, "It wasn't just him, honey. You had to stop him long before he got to that window." Followed by, "What I'm saying, Crystal, is you're going to have to take responsibility in some of this. How much of it you take is up to you, but you got to take some of it." Now, when you string together her lines and what happened, they are a chorus of victim-blaming discourse. Sitting in the audience, and I want to share this with you because it's important, sitting in the audience in a theater, I was even more horrified because in the audience, I watched heads nod, and I heard people say out loud, "Uh-huh," in agreement with Gilda's counsel. Now, this is not to say that mothers are not responsible for protecting their children, but rather it is to mark the danger of a scene that my students watch that indicates that a violently abused woman has the agency, when in actuality, we know they don't, right? Additional examples of characters that are problematically consistent with the controlling images of Black womanhood, and let me tell you, folks, there are many. Gilda, very indicative of a mammy figure. She's a caretaker and manager of the building. Tangie, the lady in orange, is very much positioned as a promiscuous Jezebel. Joe, the lady in red, is very much positioned as a combination between the matriarch. She emasculates her Black husband, who then confesses, and this is, too, a space where homophobia walks in the door. He confesses that he doesn't identify as gay but has sex with men because it's no strings attached, right? Because Joe has all of the control in their relationship. And Joe is often very much positioned as a sapphire. And in the film, when she is diagnosed with a sexually transmitted disease, it becomes easy to walk through that door of, well, if she wouldn't have been so mean to her husband, then he wouldn't have slept around with men at that. There's that homophobia. And then she wouldn't have gotten the STD. And of course, there's Juanita, the lady in green, who also, in very striking ways, is depicted as a mammy figure in relation to her male partner, Carl. So these are just a few examples of how the film is problematic, okay? But again, to be fair, I want us to shift into a space of hope where we recognize any given pop culture text as being both good and bad, both progressive and problematic, right? So I want to do some talking about Tyler Perry. Oh, I forgot to show you. The controlling images, right, and victim blaming marks Crystal as deserving of her pain, unable to protect herself and her children, and at fault for the deaths of her children. And then when we move forward to get into that both-and space, what we can see is something equally as important, but something very important to mark about raising consciousness through pop culture is the idea. Sometimes I feel like my students, my friends, my family members, they think, well, because the film does this really good thing, the bad things it does are okay. We can have a both-and relationship without doing addition and subtraction, right? The ways that a pop culture text, like a song, a TV show, or a film, does good things, they don't dismiss or erase the bad things. So we really do need to get into this idea of talking about pop culture texts that very much simultaneously do both, in terms of resisting the normalization of violence against women and reproducing the normalization of violence against women. So let's talk about some of the ways that Tyler Perry might be progressive. And I say might be, right, because I struggle, but there's still some really powerful moments in the film that I think are worthy of paying attention to. And first and foremost is Tyler Perry's commitment to honoring Black womanhood, right? He is very explicit in most of the interviews that he gives that the work that he does is dedicated to the women in his life. He talks about his mother, his aunts, and his grandmother as being very significant. And he also publicly respects his, he also publicly marks his respect for women as a whole, okay? A great example of Tyler Perry trying to do his best and marking his good intent is while the film was in production, he said, quote, "Rest assured that I am going to stay very true to what Entezaki Shange has done." Now, here's the thing, folks. You and I know that good intent isn't going to get me from this door off, or from this podium to that door. It's not going to work. We have to look at intent coupled with outcome. You can mean to do great, wonderful things, and you can stick your size 10 foot in your mouth and reproduce every form of oppression that you're trying not to reproduce. So I want to mark that he had good intent, but perhaps it didn't just quite follow through as much as what we might have liked to see. I also want to mark that Tyler Perry, because he is a multi-million dollar, access to billions of dollars in capital film producer, that he had the ability, the power, the privilege, and the visibility to bring For Colored Girls to a mainstream venue. Even if it had only stayed in more of an independent film venue, we know that not as many people would have seen it and perhaps been introduced to Entezaki Shange's important work. And For Colored Girls, and this is where, you know, again, I get into that both and struggle space, it's in the long line of mainstream films directed by men about the pride and pain of Black women, right? Including The Color Purple, Beloved, and Precious, all directed by men, mostly white men. We have yet to see a mainstream film about Black women and gender violence in the mass media. That in and of itself is a problem. Also of importance to note in terms of his power, privilege, and visibility, and this is the part that I really struggle with, is that Perry purchased the screenplay from Anzinka Stewart, and she is a Black female producer that had been working on the screenplay with Shange. He bought the rights to the screenplay from a Black female film producer and opted to produce it himself. The question becomes, why didn't he back the Black female producer already working with Shange, right? That's a problem from a Black feminist standpoint. Yet, visibility matters, and it matters huge because, again, he was able to position the film as culturally relevant. He was able to afford the marketing and the advertising to bring the film into a space where many, many folks would have access to it. So we can't undercut the power, privilege, and visibility of Tyler Perry, but I do believe that we definitely simultaneously have to consider the ways that he used his male privilege to undercut the work of a Black female film producer and really the original work of Entezaki Shange, because her original work does not produce controlling images the way that Tyler Perry did, okay? I also want us to recognize the power of representation and resistant potential, and these last two points really have to do with where we can understand the film through a progressive lens. I'm going to share with you my sentiments out loud, and I'm going to describe the rape scene again because people see it, and we need to talk about what people see. For me, Yasmin, who plays the lady in yellow, that's who you see on your right, she is such a powerful example of how Black women can identify with the narratives depicted in the film. She is a vibrant dance instructor. And when I say vibrant, I mean not only through the color yellow, but also in terms of the ways that her character is positioned. She loves life. She's got a career. She has her own dance studio. She's very much a woman in a position of power in relation to her own life. And eventually, she's raped in her home by her date, Bill. Early on in their acquaintanceship, we are introduced to Bill in the film as a dangerous creep. The audience knows that Bill is a creep far before Yasmin knows that he's a creep because he nonverbally reveals himself behind her back. And the moment happens when he claims to be interested in her safety as he watches her unlock her door. And in this moment, going back to what was happening in the theater, myself included, everyone gasped when he scowled at her back and then became supremely confident, telling the camera that he would take what he wanted and soon. And our gasps in the dark theater, folks, let me tell you what they affirmed for me in that moment. They sent chills up my spine because we were all gasping out of recognition. We knew him. We were gasping because we are familiar with the embodied look of a man that has every intention to harm a woman, whether she grants consent or not. We gasped out of recognition, which was a powerful moment for me. Shortly after Bill outs his, unbeknownst to Yasmin, harmful intentions, he accepts her invitation to a home-cooked meal. When he arrives at her apartment, many of us in the theater shifted uneasily in our seats. Some folks literally did this because they didn't want to see what was going to come. He followed Yasmin toward her kitchen minutes after getting there. He licks his lips and lustfully stares at her behind, and the camera follows him as he does this. And within moments of his arrival, and I'm not kidding if you haven't seen it, he strips down butt naked as she sets the table. And the moment she turned around and saw his naked body, you could see the panic and the fear on her face. She says, "Put your clothes on." In response, Bill says, "Why? Come on, we're both adults, and I know why you asked me to come over here tonight." Then he steals from her on the floor of her living room, and he yanks up her skirt, and he rips her panties off, and he rapes her. And the camera reveals that her eyes are fixated on the bright green numbers of the clock, 8:26 and then 8:27. And I sat in that theater watching Yasmin watch the clock, and I felt sickened by memory and saved by the passage of time. So in reflection, I do feel obligated to acknowledge that Perry did, in fact, even if only during certain scenes, create a filmic space for the pain of gender violence in the lives of Black women to be seen. And that matters. In addition, the film cracks open the possibility of progressive Black masculinity. And the possibility, I think, is best captured by Michael Ealy. And Michael Ealy is the actor, the abusive partner, and the murderer. So for the character that plays the most controversial Black male character of the film to come forward and argue in favor of the film is important. Because both Shange's work in the 70s was heavily criticized, especially within the Black community, where it's not so socially appropriate to talk about sexism in the Black community, nor is it always welcome in the Black community to mark that for all women, most violence is intraracial. It's same race, which means that when we're talking about white women and gender violence, it typically means that white men are committing the violence. So when we're talking about Black women and gender violence, it means that Black men are committing the bulk of the gender violence. And in response to the critiques of Tyler Perry's film as a Black male-bashing text, this is what Michael Ealy has to say. "I think that if you say this movie is male-bashing, you're not looking at the bigger picture. In my opinion, the bigger picture is that the issues that were applicable in the mid-70s when the play was on Broadway are still plaguing our women and our children right now. The bigger issue is that the piece is timeless, and if you're a man who is handling your business, then you know this doesn't apply to you. This isn't a film that showcases men. This is a film that showcases the triumph of our women." That is vital, particularly coming out of the mouth of a very visible and famous Black male actor. That matters. That stance against gender violence in the lives of Black women matters. Also of importance to note is Shange's perspective on what the film has to offer Black men. She says, "The lesson is, don't beat and hurt women. Don't lie to us. Don't get us pregnant and leave us in an alley. Don't pretend you're coming for dinner when you're coming to make love. There's a whole lot of lessons in there for young black men. There's a whole lot they could do. They need to take a notepad with them to the movie and write them down. I can't do that no more. Oh, I can't do that no more. Oh, I can't do that no more. And see how many pieces of paper they have when they leave, if they were honest. So there is a progressive male space that is opened up in this film, particularly if we couple Shange's insight with not only the actors and actresses' insight, but also with the representations of what we see. I want to emphasize the absolute significance of raising critical consciousness about pop culture. It is so easy to say that any given film, television show, or song is good or bad. But rather, critical consciousness means doing the labor of both and. What can we learn? What can we challenge? What can we help other folks to see? Importantly, ending with Shange's own words, she says, "I am on the other side of the rainbow, picking up the pieces of days spent waiting for the poem to be heard. While you listen, I have other work to do."
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CalCASA.org.